Prescription drug prices jumped into the news last week as doctors, patients, and others reacted angrily to a 5,000% price increase for medication. The drug Daraprim is not one of the better-known medications. It's used to treat a condition called toxoplasmosis. The company, Turing Pharmaceuticals, bought the rights to the drug and raised the price from $1,350 a pill to over $750 a pill. After a backlash, the company backed down, but not before the issue had drawn attention to other sudden large price increases at other companies and prompted some calls for reform. Democratic presidential candidates responded, saying some kind of fix was needed, and drug company shares went down. Two guests join us now for a look at prescription drugs, past and present. Joseph Gabriel is a visiting associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy and author of the book Medical Monopoly, Intellectual Property Rights and the Origins of the Modern Pharmaceutical Industry. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Jeremy Green is an associate professor of medicine and the history of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He's the author of the book Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. Jeremy, thanks for joining us again.
It's a pleasure to be here today, Rob. Thanks.
And Jeremy, I usually think of two categories of prescription drugs. The new patented brand name stuff could be really expensive. The generics, they're popular, a lot of producers, they're usually cheap. But the drug in this case and others are different. They have a relatively limited use. The people who need them seem to really need them. How common are these kind of medications?
Well, it's hard to give a precise number, but there are many classes of medicines in which old effective medicines, even medicines that are essential drugs by the classifications of the World Health Organization, have fallen into the hands of just a few, or even in the case of Daraprim and actually other drugs like albendazole for another Arab antiparasitic agent, where they're just produced by one company. And I think your question points at a real problem we have in the assumptions we make about how we balance innovation and access in pharmaceutical policy. We like to think that very new drugs that are innovative and are protected by a patent monopoly can be available at very high prices, that innovative companies can recoup the costs of development. And then once they go off patent, that all of these different generic companies swoop in and the invisible hand matches supply and demand and we have low prices. And for many drugs, it works that way, at least initially. But what we've come to learn, particularly in the last 10 years, is that for a large section of the pharmaceutical economy, generic competition either never happens or goes away, and we see these retro-monopolistic actions, which Martin Shkreli's actions at Turing Pharmaceuticals really brought to the forefront of the national attention this last week.
And Joe, let's go back in time a little. The system that Jeremy was referring to of intellectual property and patents, we take it for granted now. It wasn't always that way. In fact, you've written that the idea of patenting drugs and having monopolies on the rights was looked down on in the medical profession. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, sure. It wasn't just looked down on. It was considered outright unethical. So in the decades before the Civil War, any kind of monopoly on a pharmaceutical was unethical, and it was attacked as a form of quackery. So if a drug company patented a drug, or they kept the ingredient secret, or they used some other kind of monopolistic practices, they were actually driven out of kind of respectable society. That began to change kind of towards the end of the 19th century, when there were new kind of scientific and technological developments. But the anti-monopoly perspective maintained as a very kind of central part of orthodox medical thought. And, you know, I should also say that there were a number of very intense efforts to try and prohibit patenting and other kinds of monopoly on drugs during the 19th century. The AMA, the American Medical Association, led the first effort to actually prohibit pharmaceutical patenting in 1847. Retail druggists made a similar effort towards the end of the century. And, you know, these efforts failed, but they do point to kind of this really deep public and scientific and professional concern about the role of monopoly in the marketplace.
Well, clearly a different vision ultimately won out. And Jeremy, the argument usually is, and you alluded to it already, that companies need to make profits. They need a monopoly to make the profit, at least for a while, to pay for a lot of research and development, a lot of which is fruitless, a lot of which doesn't ever produce a marketable product. Is there some argument to be made for that?
Well, I mean, I think the argument is made all the time, and we see the dollar value that is supposedly attached to any new drug that makes it through the FDA is consistently being inflated. I mean, a number of economists have called into question the means by which the industry comes up with this price tag of how much is spent for every new drug that is made available. But I guess the point I want to make, just to emphasize the importance of of Joe's scholarship and then the point he was just making, is that we get locked in these really narrow debates about how can we deal with problems of drug prices because we need to incent development, and if we touch that, we're going to kill the goose that lays the golden eggs. And what I think historical scholarship can do to add to this debate is to show that there are many more options, and in fact, the whole system that we're debating was actually itself considered immoral and unacceptable to society not that long ago, historically speaking.
Talking to Dr. Jeremy Green and Joe Gabriel about prescription drugs, their prices, based on last week's flurry of news around a 5,000% price increase for a medication that's been around for a while, not a wide audience, essential for a lot of people. Joe, I want to pick up on that point Jeremy was just raising there, the history that led up to us thinking about prescription drugs and their pricing in this one particular way. So how did we go from that state where the medical community thought this is unethical to have monopolies on drugs to the current state of affairs where that is the state of affairs? That's how we do things.
Yeah, well, in the late 19th century, reformers were actually very concerned about the state of the drug market. So this was before there was a robust regulatory system in place. And, you know, a lot of the concern at that time was actually about drugs being too inexpensive, right? Because the idea was that as drug prices went down, the quality of products went down. And patents and trademarks, to a lesser extent, were actually seen by some reformers as a means of improving the quality of drugs in the marketplace, right? So you could take, if a very reputable firm took out a patent on a drug, it was, you know, reformers made the argument that that patent would allow the company to control the market and ensure high-quality products. So that was one of the ways kind of they justified the use of patents.
I want to talk about the role of doctors. Joe, you had been talking about doctors fighting the idea of intellectual property rights, monopolies on things. Well, now, in this Daraprim case that was in the news last week and others, it's doctors taking the lead in fighting these price increases and drawing attention to that. Have they always been as directly involved, Joe, in these issues, or is this something kind of new?
No, I think the medical community has always been one of the leading groups to oppose monopoly in the drug marketplace. Okay, you know, there's a sense in which monopoly, at least in the 19th century, was considered to impede science, right? If you monopolize information about a drug or the use of a drug, it interferes with the ability of other physicians to use that drug for the benefit of their patients, right? So monopoly was thought of as harming patients and harming the public good. You know, and so I think physicians have always had kind of an anti-monopolistic attitude towards the drug market. Personally, I think that, you know, physicians really need to kind of step up and take the lead on pushing an anti-monopolistic position in today's marketplace.
Yeah, Jeremy, go ahead.
Sorry, just to amplify that point. I mean, I like Joe, I'm a historian. I'm also a practicing clinician, and I see patients in a community health center in East Baltimore. And many of the patients that I see really fall between the cracks in terms of the kinds of health plans that we have available. And every week, it seems, I learn of a new way in which a drug that I thought of as being so old that it must be broadly available for pennies a pill has been jacked up in price. So I want to amplify this because I think many of my colleagues in medicine make the assumption that old drugs, because they're old, are affordable. And one of the things that Shkreli has done this last week in this very publicized case of 5,000% price increase on an old drug invented in 1953 is to help to demonstrate that there is a role for advocacy, this kind of advocacy that clinicians should not assume that their patients can afford drugs just because they're old. That we need to continuously be listening to our patients and learning more about the things that we assume are affordable that in truth are not.
For doctors in other developed countries, can they make that assumption? Are things different enough there that this old but essential drug, they can prescribe it knowing that it isn't going to break the bank?
I mean, certainly the case of Daraprim, this extraordinary price hike from $1,350 to $750 a pill is unique to the United States market. And of course, in many sectors, really pretty much all sectors of the pharmaceutical marketplace, we pay the highest drug prices in the United States. Many advocates for the pharmaceutical industry say that it needs to be that way, that in fact the U.S. prices are propping up the entire system of innovation. But certainly a number of things take place to help markets be guaranteed in the U.S. where they would be fined more competitively if, for example, parallel importation of drugs in Canada or Europe were allowed for American consumers.
That's Dr. Jeremy Green, author of Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. Also with us is Joe Gabriel, author of Medical Monopoly, Intellectual Property Rights, and the Origins of the Modern Pharmaceutical Industry. We're looking at the story behind prescription drug prices after last week's news about a 5,000% increase in a medication got an outraged reaction, led to the company in question saying they were going to dial it back down. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a perspective as a patient or a provider or working in the pharmaceutical industry, love to hear what you think. And do you think something needs to change when it comes to the cost of prescriptions? Were you one of the people outraged by the news last week about this big jump in a drug price? Or do you think the cost of drugs is justified by the research and development that goes into them? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with pharmacy professor Joe Gabriel at UW-Madison and Dr. Jeremy Green from Johns Hopkins. We're looking at the world of prescription medication and what it costs, past, present, maybe future. The issue hit the news last week after a small pharmaceutical company bought the rights to a prescription medication, increased its price by 5,000%. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 as a healthcare patient or provider. What do you think about drug prices? What confuses you about them? Do you think the system needs to change? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller. We've got Mary on the line in Boscobel. Mary, hi.
Hi. I just have a couple questions. One is, everywhere I looked, I've never found out how they're moving that price back down. Is it going to be down to $500 or down to $2 or what? And the other thing is, I'd like to know if these drug companies are receiving federal money in their research and development.
Mary, thanks for the call. Joe, you were shaking your head. I think we don't know what the price would go back down to that high.
I don't think he made it clear. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's a good chance that the company's just going to wait it out and reduce it by a very tiny amount, to be honest.
Jeremy, the role of government funding in R&D.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know the specifics in the case of pyrimethidine, but certainly, that question really opens up a much broader thing in the case that, Turing Pharmaceuticals did absolutely nothing to develop pyrimethidine. So regardless of how much of that drug was developed privately versus publicly, absolutely 0% of its development came from investment from Turing Pharmaceuticals. Now, I'd like to add one other thing, which is no matter how much it goes down, let's say it went all the way back down to $13.50 a pill. One would ask, why is it even $13.50 a pill? I mean, this is a drug that is old. It costs a tiny amount to make each pill. In other countries, it's available for much cheaper. Even before Turing acquired it, it was available already as a monopoly by another company that had already taken the price up to $13.50, which one could argue is already too high.
And Joe, the argument from Turing and again from other companies is these higher prices are buying the next generation of medications. Do you see it panning out that way?
Not really, to be honest. If we look over the course of the 20th century, the vast majority of scientific work that has gone into developing truly innovative new drugs has come out of the academy. It's come out of universities and the scientists who work at universities. Drug companies only invest maybe 15 to 18% of their budget back into the research and development process. They also have incredibly high profit margins. They have profit margins of about 20%. Right. The oil industry, by comparison, only has a 10% profit margin. Okay, so these companies make a tremendous amount of money, and they're not putting back nearly as much into R&D as they kind of present themselves as doing. You know, a lot of their products are also not really that good. They're not necessarily innovations. They're just kind of marginal innovations on already existing products. So, you know, I personally don't really buy this whole kind of argument that they need to have these extreme prices in order to justify R&D expenses.
Mary, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Stuart with us in Chippewa Falls. Stuart, hi.
Hi. You just actually kind of touched on it, but I was just going to ask, if these drug prices are regulated and kept down, how are these pharmaceutical companies going to be able to continue research into developing new drugs? Because it does cost a $1 billion for a new drug.
But Jeremy, you want to jump in on that?
So I think it's an open question. So one could take a look at Turing Pharmaceuticals, for example, and say, well, they're charging $750 a pill, but they could, since they are the only company making the pill, just stop making the pill altogether if they decide it's unprofitable. So I think there is a real question here as to what happens when we entrust what is really an essential set of resources, part of what I would argue to be the basic infrastructure of modern biomedical practice, to a private industry and assume that the invisible hand is going to work to match supply and demand in a timely fashion for patients. And I think that the question as it was asked really applies to this concept of new drugs. What is so egregious about the Turing case is that it's an old drug, and these are these things that fall off of our sensibility, just as shortages in basic medical supplies because of oligopolistic and monopolistic tendencies have affected even the supply of something as simple as IV saline, salt water, which my clinic could not get for several weeks this last spring.
Joe, I know sometimes foundations hold patents. I mean, is there a nonprofit sector in the drug ownership and production world?
Not that I know of. I mean, not really, no.
Although I think that's a great question.
That's a great question.
One can imagine, why couldn't there be, especially for these older drugs like Daraprim?
Yeah, and the American Medical Association actually proposed doing that around 1914. They had a resolution on the floor of their organization that said that they would create a body that would hold patents for new drugs in the public interest. And that became the model for academic units to patent medicines kind of through the 20th century, right, the early 20th century. They would patent them, and then they would give licenses to drug companies, but the university would hold the patent in the public trust, right?
Talking to Joe Gabriel from UW-Madison's Pharmacy School, Dr. Jeremy Green from Johns Hopkins University, talking about prescription drugs and how prices are set. We'll go back to our callers now with Jeff in Appleton. Jeff, hi.
Hi. I've been a diabetic for 35 years, and I have to buy insulin to stay alive, basically. The problem with insurance with insulin and probably other drugs is that the only insulin I can purchase is labeled as a Tier 1 drug. And when it's a Tier 1 drug versus a 2 or a 3, you have to pay almost the full amount of the insulin. There are no other choices. Mm-hmm. So in order to get the insulin I need to stay alive, I have to pay the full price because it's the only choice I have.
Jeff, thanks for that call. Jeremy, is this something you encounter with your patients in Baltimore?
Oh, certainly. And this is something I only became aware of in the past few years, that insulin is a drug that was invented in 1921, patented in 1923. I and pretty much all of my colleagues assumed that it was available generically at a very cheap price for people living with diabetes. And I learned, actually, that several of my patients were unable to afford their diabetes, partly because they didn't have insurance, or in the case of Jeff, that increasing exposure to patients of the true cost of medicines has made an essential medicine like insulin unreachable or potentially unreachable for patients who require it to survive. It's really an unthinkable situation, and yet it is happening for many, many people around the country today. One of the things that many people with diabetes have turned to as a result, because insulin is only, there is no generic insulin in the United States, it's only available in brand name form still in 2015 at very high prices, that Walmart paradoxically offers a $25 insulin. Now, it's a very basic form of insulin, and it's only through Walmart. It's because they have their marketing muscle or they can price it as a loss leader. But many people with diabetes have told me stories where they have, when they've moved, selectively sought out places with Walmart so that they know they can live. And yet, this is a very thin protection. This is a private company doing this on its own with no fiduciary responsibility to people living with diabetes. They could terminate this program at any moment. So I think, Jeff, thank you for sharing your story. It's a tragic story, and it's one which I think needs much more attention.
Jeff, thanks for that call, and good luck to you. Ed is with us now in Lodi. Ed, hi.
Yes. I worked in the pharmaceutical industry for a number of years, and I just wanted to add a perspective on the cost and return of essentially introducing a new drug. When I was there, we had like a 1 in 7,000 success rate that a product we developed or some new chemical that would be effective would be successfully returned to the you know, a successful return to the company. And the idea was that we did basic research, and we also worked with universities on the basic research. But then, essentially, if a drug looked promising, then we essentially had to go through process R&D that would basically say, well, how do you make this thing in volume in order to reach the numbers? And then at the same time, once you did all that, you had to go through the FDA approval process, the three stages. And then essentially then you'd had to look at the competitive marketing side.
Ed, thanks a lot for bringing that up. I want to bring our guests in on this. Given that finding a new drug can be a shot in the dark, Joe, how can we incentivize that kind of research and development being done?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, right? And especially, you know, I think for me at least, the real question is how can you incentivize research in a way that monopoly doesn't distort the market, right? Or monopoly doesn't lead to what are really unsustainable price barriers for people. You know, there's different models for how to do that. For example, the economist Joseph Stiglitz suggested offering very large prizes to companies who develop new products. There's other kinds of systems you could come up with that aren't reliant on kind of this cycle of patenting that leads to this kind of boom and bust system for companies.
And Jeremy, briefly as we wrap up, with this conversation that's been happening that flared up last week over drug price increases, do you think there's a realistic possibility that some kind of change, maybe for the better, could happen in the next 5-10 years?
Oh, I think there is, and I think there really needs to be some form of change. I think one thing to focus on, you know, if you look at the case of Martin Shkreli, you know, he went out before the cameras and has become, in some ways, like the most hated person in America this week. Who knows who the most hated person will be next week? But, you know, the social media is full of accounts calling him a jerk, referring to him as Pharma Bro. That's become the preferred name for referring to him. And I think the problem here is that this attack can so quickly get limited to just an ad hominem. And really what Shkreli is doing is almost serving as an illustration of the power of monopoly in the American pharmaceutical sector for old drugs as well as for new drugs. So in many ways, Shkreli's done a tremendous service to those who want to see essential medicines available for afforded prices for Americans by showing how egregiously important this subject is. And I think there is a lot of potential for change.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
And Joe, thanks to you as well.
Yeah, thank you very much.
We've been talking to Dr. Jeremy Green from Johns Hopkins University, author of Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine, and Joseph Gabriel, visiting associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. His book is Medical Monopoly, Intellectual Property Rights, and the Origins of the Modern Pharmaceutical Industry.